The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 18th day of March, 2018. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We have a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we have the legendary captain of the gold medal-winning Miracle on Ice team from the 1980 Winter Olympics in Lake Placid, Mike Ruzioni, joins us. In the second half, we'll talk to former Major League Baseball hurler Bob Tewksbury about his new book, 90% Metal. An all-star player turned mental skills coach reveals the hidden game of baseball. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Got some great stuff for you. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page called Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, more stuff. So stop by, give us a look, and then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. My first guest, captain, as I said, of the gold medal-winning Miracle Team USA from the 1980 Winter Olympics up in Lake Placid. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Mike Ruzioni. Mike, good evening.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Great to have you with us, Mike. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Growing up in Massachusetts, Mike, probably a foregone conclusion. Who are your favorite teams and your favorite players up there?
Well, obviously, I support all our teams. I love all our teams, the Red Sox, the Patriots, the Bruins, the Celtics.
Right.
I guess as a kid, you know, growing up, Bill Russell, John Havlicek, Bob Cousy, then later on, obviously, Larry Bird. And, growing up in a house that was very athletic and very active, big fans of the Bruins. In my era, you know, Johnny Busick was a big guy. And then obviously Bobby Orr came along. And baseball players, Kyle Yastrzemski, Jim Lomborg. I mean, I can go on. And,
sure.
You know, talk about these guys and the football players. I remember Gino Cappelletti and Babe Parilli. And again, that's when I was a kid. And now obviously we've got Tom Brady and the success of the Patriots the last few years. So it's a great city to grow up in. And it's a city for sports.
It definitely is. Definitely is, Mike. You're exactly right. It's sort of like being in New York, except you guys win. We have trouble. We have trouble. Don't want to talk about Tom Brady when you're a Jet fan, but one thing people may not know is Babe Parilli, during the Super Bowl year of 1969, was the backup for Joe Namath. Did you know that, Mike?
Oh, no, you know what? And I knew Babe. I got to know I caddied for him when I was a kid. I did not know that. That's a great trivia question.
Yeah, he was the backup for Joe Namath. And later on, it was Al Woodall. But you graduated from Winthrop Senior High School in 72. You were captain of the hockey team during your high school years, too.
Yeah, I was fortunate. That was, I played a lot of sports in high school. Hockey was something I did in the wintertime. My real passion in high school was football. And I tell people I probably played more baseball in my life than I played anything. So, I grew up in a small town, and we kind of relied on three-sport athletes. So if you grew up in Winthrop, you probably played three sports, and I was fortunate, and I loved all three of them that I played.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you went to Berwick Academy. That was a New England prep school. You attended Boston University. You were a Terrier. You initially opted for another school, but I read that you switched to be you after the coach forgot your name. Tell us a little bit about that, Mike.
I don't know where that came from. That's not true at all.
Okay.
I laugh about that. I don't know who came up with that idea or that concept, but I was not recruited out of high school, out of prep school. I wanted to play football, hockey, and baseball in college, and I wanted to go to the University of New Hampshire, and they didn't think I was good enough to play hockey there, so I had really no place to go to school, and I was actually going to Merrimack College, which at the time was a Division II school, playing in a summer league game. I didn't play hockey in the summer. I played baseball in the summer. And got a phone call from a friend of mine that they needed a guy to play and in a summer league game, and I said, well, you need a guy, I'll play. So I went and I played in the game, and the guy refereeing the game was a guy named Jack Parker, who was the assistant coach at Boston University. And they had a scholarship available because a kid from Canada decided not to come, and he offered me the scholarship. I took the scholarship and ended up at Boston University. So that's how that happened.
That's the true story, folks, right there.
That's the now, true story.
Jack Parker called you the Pete Rose on skates. Is that true?
Yeah, there was an article in the Globe about me, Boston Globe. It called me, you know, Pete Rose's nickname and when he was playing was Charlie Hustle.
Right.
And that's what Jack used to say. Yeah, I used to hustle all the time on the ice. I was a worker. I played hard. Things that my dad taught me when I was a young kid, that no matter what you do, if you walk, you run to first base. If you pop up, you run to first base. You play on the hockey game, you play hard every time. And that was something that I kind of prided myself on, that I was pretty competitive.
You sure were. We're speaking to Mike Arruzzioni tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, you played for Team USA at the 75 and 76 World Championships, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I was one of the few college – well, the first year, it was all college players, and we went over to the World Championships. Bob Johnson was our coach, and we played against the Soviets and all the other countries who were all professionals and pretty well got handed – I think we were 0-10, the 10 games that we played. Again, this is college players that didn't even practice together. We got selected, and we went over and played. Then the next year, I was able to play again, and they had a little mixture of European pro players. And we won a few games that year. But it was a great experience playing overseas. I was in Munich and Dusseldorf was the one year, and the second year was in Poland, in Katowice, which was a great experience.
Now, you played with the Gold Diggers. Now, prior to the 80 Olympics, your amateur status was sort of called into question by Allan Eagleson, right?
Yeah, of all people to question Allan Eagleson. He said Ken Morrow and I were considered professionals. Kenny supposedly had signed a contract already with the Islanders, which was not true.
Okay.
And I was playing in Toledo as an amateur. I was not under contract. The New York Rangers had my rights, and they sent me to Toledo to play, but not as an NHL contracted player. So I was paid, I think my first year in Toledo, $3,500, and I had to pay my own apartment, my own rent, my own expenses. And it was a deal where I could get cut and traded at any point. I was not under contract with anybody other than an amateur contract. And, Allan Eagleson considered me a professional, which is so far from the truth. But, you know, again, he's a Canadian. He wasn't very happy when we won the gold medal.
I bet. No. Now, talk a little bit about the selection process that Herb Brooks went through to pick the Olympic team, Mike.
Well, they had open tryouts all around the country. Anybody who was an amateur could try out for the Olympic team, and they selected 68 of us, and 68 of us went to Colorado Springs. And in July, prior to the Olympic year, we competed against each other, and Herb Brooks sat in the stands and evaluated all the players and selected 26 of us. So 26 players made up the 80 Olympic team. And then we got together in September out of Minneapolis where we were going to be based, and we were going to train for 6 months. And throughout the course of our training, six players were going to get cut from the team, and we could narrow it down. Only 20 were going to go to Lake Placid. So from a few hundred to 68 to 26, and then the final number was 20.
So that was the criteria that Herb used for the numbers, folks. Now, we got Mike Arruzzioni with us, the team captain. How were you named team captain, Mike? How did that go about?
It was a player vote.
Okay.
You know, I still don't know to this day if I was voted captain by my teammates. It was Herb said we're gonna vote, and we voted, and then the next day at practice he said, Mike, you're the captain, and that's the way it was. And it was nice, but it wasn't a big deal. You know, I was on a team of 20 players, and I think 18 of them were captains of their college or high school teams, so there were a lot of good leaders in that room, a lot of good teammates who had been very, very competitive and great leaders themselves.
Yeah, sure were. Now, were there the hostility between the Minnesota Golden Gopher players and the Boston U players on the team?
Yeah, that kind of happened when we were in college. Boston University and the University of Minnesota at the national championships my junior year, we had a bench-clearing brawl about 3-4 minutes into the game.
Wow.
And then the next year at the Olympic Festival, Team Minnesota and Team Massachusetts in the warm-up had a bench-clearing brawl. So there was a lot of animosity prior, but once our team was picked, we never once had an issue. We actually kind of joked about it. So there was never an issue once we were put together as a team, but prior to that, there was a lot of anguish between the two teams,
the two states,
so to speak.
Now, as depicted in the movie Miracle, which most people have seen, you guys called it Herbie's, skating from line to line. Now, is it true that in the arena in Norway, the guys turned off the lights and you guys were still out there skating?
Yes, they put the emergency lights were on, but there wasn't all 20 of us. Only 16 players dressed that night.
Okay.
And Buzzy Schneider actually got thrown out for fighting. So there were 15 of us that ended up doing the drills that we called Herbies.
That's a great story. Now,
yeah, it was pretty intense.
Yeah, I know. I ran Herbie, so to speak, in basketball.
Yeah, suicides or gassers, whatever they
call
them back.
Not good. Not good at all. Now,
no, you're right.
The exhibition game at the Garden against the Soviets, when they skated out with the trophy, let's talk about that game. You guys came out. How did you feel before the game, Mike?
Well, I think we were anxious and excited, and I think we were nervous because the team hadn't been finalized, and I think a lot of guys were wondering if they were going to be there in Lake Placid in the next few days, and I think the mindset of our team was just more, we couldn't wait to go to Lake Placid, and I don't think we were anywhere near prepared to play mentally as we should have been, and obviously that was the outcome of the game being a 10-3 score, so... for us, it was our last game of a long season, and we clearly got our heads handed to us.
Yeah, I remember that one. Now, was it their physicality? Was it the fact that they played together so long and they were a well-oiled machine? What was it about the Soviets?
Well, the whole thing, that they were an older team. They'd been together. Many of them played together 8-10 years. They had just beaten in 3 NHL teams in the NHL All-Stars 6-0.
Yeah.
You know, they were a great team. That was their life. That was their livelihood. They were a team of professionals from the Soviet Union, one country, not like today where there's about 20 or 30 countries over there. So, they were just a very well, as you saw, oiled, a driven team that was pretty good.
Yeah. They sure were. Now, let's talk about the pre-medal round in the Olympics, Mike. How did that go for Team USA?
Well, it went very well for us. We needed to finish first or second in our division in order to move to the medal round, and that was really our goal, get to the medal round. If we got to the medal round, then anything could happen. So, we came out with a tie against Sweden and didn't play real well, but it was a good tie for us, and then the Czechs, who were supposed to beat us, we blew them out, beat them 7-3, and then we beat Norway, Romania, and West Germany, and everything fell into place. We were where we wanted to be, in the medal round with a chance to play for a medal.
Right, and that game came against the Soviet Union, overwhelming underdogs. How did Herb Brooks prepare the team for that game?
We prepared the same that way as we did for every game. We weren't worried about what the Soviets were doing. We were more concerned about what we were doing. We needed to play the way that we had prepared for our all year. We had trained, how we had practiced. So, we couldn't do anything different because it was the Soviets. We were playing extremely well, and there was no reason to do anything different. So Herb just told us to play our game and keep doing the things that we had done throughout the Olympic Games.
Right. Okay, we're speaking with Mike Arruzzioni tonight, Sports Talk 1240. In the first period, we had Dave Christian on last week. He took a long shot on Tradiak, who is, of course, known as the greatest goaltender in the world. Mark Johnson gets a loose puck and fires it past Vladimir with zero time on the clock. So the Soviets had a fit about that.
Yeah, they thought the clock had expired, but clearly there was 1 second left when Mark scored. you know, shame on them. They all kind of fell asleep, even Tretiak. I think they didn't know what was going to happen. And the only person on the ice that went to the net to get the puck was Mark Johnson. And that's typical Mark Johnson. Mark Johnson was a great player. So, you know, they got a little lazy and we capitalized.
Never gave up, exactly. And the movie shows Tikhanov having a fit. Now, in the next period, he pulls Tretiak, and Herb Brooks makes a point of telling you guys that they just pulled the greatest goaltender in the world.
Yeah, that was in the movie. I don't remember Herb saying anything like that to us. Again, we were never worried about who the goalies were or who was playing. You got to remember, their backup goalie was the goalie who shut out the NHL All-Stars 6-0.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I tell people that's like taking out Patrick Roy and putting in Martin Brodeur.
Yeah. this
goalie was pretty good as well.
Yeah, he was no amateur, yeah. Now, years later, I read, Mike, that Mark Johnson asked Fetisov what he thought about that. He was a teammate of his, or he met him somewhere along the line. And Fetisov says Tikhanov was crazy.
Yeah, I heard he had made that comment. I guess you always wondered what the Soviet players were thinking about it. But like I said earlier, we weren't concerned about them. We needed to take care of what we needed to do.
Right. The game's tied. The go ahead goal is scored by Mike Arruzzioni. Talk about that play, Mike.
Well, you know, it was just a play that kind of happened during the course of the game. Anybody, you know, as you well know, you follow the game of hockey, things happen, plays develop. And I was up next. Buzzy Schneider came off the ice. So he dumped the puck in the zone. He came off for a line change. I jumped over the boards, and John Harrington tipped the puck up to Mark Pavlich, and Pav saw me coming over the blue line and was able to kind of check it and tip it off to me. And I had the puck, and there was a defenseman in front of me, and I figured I'd use him as a screen. If he came at me, I was going to pass the puck by him to, I think it was Davey and John Harrington were both going to the net. And he stayed, and I used him as a screen and was able to score put it where I wanted to put it, and it went in. It was kind of similar to a goal that I scored in when we lost 10-3 to the Soviets in Madison Square Garden. I scored a goal, and if you ever look back on it, it's almost the exact same goal that I scored during the Olympic Games, just, coming across my body, using the guy as a screen, and found the corner, gave us the lead.
Sure did. Now, that little dance that you did has gone down in history as one of the highlights in sports in all of history. Now, was that just a product of elation? Talk a little bit about what happened right after that goal, Mike.
Yeah, I'm not that smart. I was excited. I guess, we see people, react after scoring goals, and it was just a reaction. It was maybe a little of my Italian energy coming out in me.
There you go. Yeah, like Brandi Chastain pulling her shirt off, right? I bet you she didn't think about that, or maybe she did. Who knows,
yeah.
Mike?
It's a reaction that you have.
Right. Now, the pressure that the Soviets put on you guys in the third period, that was unreal, wasn't it?
Well, you knew they were going to make a charge.
Yeah.
And, they did it early in the period, but after I scored, the last 10 minutes, they didn't have many shots on goal. And I think somebody told me, I haven't seen the game in a long time, but somebody told me they only had about 4 or 5 shots in the last 10 minutes. So, again, in the movie, they have 100 shots being taken.
They do, yeah. I mean, they're killing Craig left and right in the movie.
Yeah, there weren't that many shots taken.
Interesting to note. Now, Tikhanov never pulls the goalie for an extra attacker. Now, do you think that's just a reaction by that guy? Because he was never faced with this before.
Well, you wonder. They'd never been behind.
Right.
So, I was very surprised. And, again, on the bench, was thinking, okay, well, let's wait for the goalie to get pulled. Let's wait. And it never happened.
Right.
So I don't know if anybody ever asked him after. I wasn't in any of the media events, so I don't know if that was a question put to him, why he didn't pull the goalie. My guess is he probably didn't even go to the press conference because he probably wasn't very happy with the way the game ended.
Well, in the movie, it's got Herb telling Craig Patrick he doesn't know what to do, he says.
Yeah.
I guess he didn't.
I don't know what was said or not said.
Yeah, okay. Now, The atmosphere on the ice after the game, as we know, as we could see, unbelievable. Team USA beats the Soviet Union. Do you believe in miracles? I mean, just unreal. These guys were clearly shocked, though. They're standing there waiting for you to shake hands. What was the handshake like?
Well, for me, it was pretty emotional. It was pretty fun for them. They just kind of were staring at us. They didn't. It's almost like they couldn't fathom that they had lost.
Yeah.
It was you know, there was no expression on their faces. It was just very, very empty look.
Okay. Yeah. I can imagine. That was the look that the movie paints on the guys, too, on the Soviets. Now, we go to the gold medal game against Finland, and you guys are behind again.
Well, if you follow any of it, we were behind in every game but one.
Yeah.
We were behind Sweden. We were behind Czechoslovakia. We were behind Norway. We were behind West Germany. We were behind the Soviets. And we were behind Finland. So that wasn't anything uncommon with our team. We just had great confidence in what we were doing and how we were playing. And, you know, other than the West German game, we were never behind by more than two goals at any point. West Germany jumped up 2-0 on us, and we came back and beat them 4-2. But all the other games, we were, you know, just down a goal and, you know, right in it at all times.
Right. Now, did Herb really tell you guys going to the final period that you'll take this to your graves if you don't win?
Yes. That
yeah.
was exactly what he said. He said it not once, but he said it twice.
Yeah. And that must have had a great impact on you fellas.
Well, yeah, you realize, we didn't go to the Olympics to win one game. We went with
right.
the hope and dreams of winning the whole thing. And, you know, it's funny, years later, people still think we only played one game, but we played
yeah.
We played a lot of games in order to win that medal.
And now, after the Olympics, Mike, you're one of five guys on the team not drafted. Was that a surprise to you?
No, actually, the Rangers had my rights.
Okay.
From when I was in college. And actually, the Hartford Whalers drafted me in the second round when I was in college. But they were in the WHA at the time. So I was a free agent after the Olympic Games. And I was negotiating at the time with the Rangers, the Buffalo Sabres, and the Minnesota North Stars. And just decided, after sitting down with myself, my parents, and just thinking about what I wanted to do, and decided that was it for me, and it was time to move on and do something else.
Okay. Yeah, what did you do? You went into broadcasting?
I did some broadcasting. I did some coaching. I still, I did a lot of motivational speaking, which I continue to do now. And I work at Boston University. I've been
right.
at Boston University 20-some-odd years in the development office. It's almost like an ambassadorship role for the university where I went to school.
What a great job.
It's a great place to be as
yeah.
well. Not only is it a great university academically, but we've got a pretty good hockey program. We've had some pretty good players come through there over the years.
Definitely, yeah. A pretty good job you got set up with there, Mike. Definitely. Nice. Now, I had read that Patrick O'Brien Dempsey, who played you in the movie Miracle, he trained with one of your teams.
Yeah, I was a high school coach. I still do. I help out with our high school team, and he wanted to get to know me and get to know a little bit about my background, although he's from the Boston area. But, yeah, he came and practiced with the high school team a couple of days. It was kind of fun.
Definitely. So these days you're just going around working for BU.
Working at BU and still doing a lot of motivational speaking, traveling around the country. It keeps me pretty busy. And I've got a little business venture of a company that I'm involved with, Dan Jansen, Bonnie Blair, Bart Connor, and Nadia Comaneci. It's a health, nutrition, diet company called Zija, Z-I-J-A. And we deal with health and fitness products. So it's kind of fun to be involved in that as well.
Nice. What's it? You got a website for that, Mike?
I guess you just go on Zija, Z-I-J-A, and you can pull up the company and the products that they offer.
Z-I-J-A, folks. That's Mike Aruzioni with Bart Connor and his wife, Nadia Comaneci, Dan Jansen, Bonnie Blair. Sounds like a who's who of gold medal winners there. Now, I just want to tell you, Mike, it's been an honor and a pleasure having you with us tonight. Thank you that we were finally able to sync up and get you on with us.
Thank you very much. And tell Mr. Tewksbury I said hello. I got a chance to meet him a few years ago when he was with the Cardinals.
And he also is a BU product, I believe.
No, I don't think he went to BU, but he's I think he's a New Hampshire kid.
He is. He is. He's a local. He works for the Red Sox now.
Oh yeah. Okay.
He's a I guess you'd call him the sports psychologist for the Red Sox.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I read that. I could use him. Tell him.
Yeah. All right. I'll let him know. Thanks a lot again, Mike. I appreciate taking your part of your Sunday night with us.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Take you. Thank you very much, Mike. Mike Arruzzioni, folks. Next up, we'll talk to former MLB hurler and motivational speaker for the Boston Red Sox, Bob Tewksbury. So stick around.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue with you tonight. I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240. March Madness in full spring, in full swing. Swing training in full swing. NFL draft in full swing. Spring training in full swing. God, I'm having a rough night tonight, Brian. Well, we had a Cinderella story at the dance already. The University of Maryland of Baltimore County beating the Virginia Cavaliers. So we'll see what happens this week, folks, with the Sweet 16. My next guest, Major League Baseball pitcher. He played for the Yankees, the Cubs, the Cardinals, the Rangers, and the San Diego Padres, as well as the Minnesota Twins. He was an All-Star in 1992, and he's currently the sports psychology coach for the Boston Red Sox. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Bob Tewksbury. Bob, good evening.
Bill, how you doing, man? It's great to be on your show. And yeah, I know it's March Madness has a way of affecting everyone's speech patterns with all the craziness yeah. that's going on.
Yeah, I feel like I'm chewing gum or something here. I don't know.
My goodness.
We just got off the phone with Mike Arruzzioni, and he wants to send you his regards. He told me to tell you he could use you these days.
Well, that's quite a compliment. I'd love to sit down and have dinner with Mike Arruzzioni. That's you've had some good guests, and I get to follow him. How lucky am I?
Yeah, he was pretty good. I can never stop talking. I could talk about the Miracle on Ice every week if I could.
I remember where I was, college, St. Leo College in Florida, and it was pretty remarkable. And I think it's really affected people, at least of my age, and with regard to the amateur status and the Olympics with professionals playing. And that was truly amazing and one of the moments that You know, I could watch the movie Miracle.
Oh yeah,
as much as you could talk about it.
Exactly. You know? It was, and in fact, last week I had Dave Christian on, who was another one of the of the guys. And the funny part about Dave is his father and his uncle were both on the Squaw Valley team that beat the Russians in 1960.
Oh, jeez! Wow.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
One of your little known facts there, Bob, that you could take away from tonight.
Yeah. Yeah, I can take away from, if nothing else, Phil, at least I have trivia for the future.
And his nephew, right, who is Brock Nelson, who plays for the New York Islanders, too. So that's a local caveat that we...
Sure, absolutely.
We tell folks. So, as you mentioned, you went to St. Leo's, and people don't know St. Leo's except for me and you. We know it's in Pasco County. It's near Dade City. Talk a little bit about your days at St. Leo's is a big baseball school.
Yeah. Well, the long story short, I went to Rutgers University out of high school. I was from a small town in New Hampshire and went to the big city and got homesick and ended up dropping out, going back home, working in a birdseed factory, mail order birdseed factory, and then St. Leo called, so I think I dropped out in late October. St. Leo called, and I re-enrolled in school in January and played on the junior varsity team because I went from Division I to Division II, so I had to sit out. It was a good experience, but I gave up 20 earned runs in 3 innings, 1 game against Manatee Junior College.
Wow.
And a theater major who was playing baseball for something to do came in and got the side out 1-2-3 after I was disposed of. But it was great. You know, the people there, the community, the athletic director, Norm Kay, and it's a wonderful place. It was a wonderful place for me. And they actually allowed me to transfer credits to finish my degree from St. Leo, which now called St. Leo University. So I'm much appreciative of the people down there for what they've done for me.
People may be asking, Bob, have any other major leaguers come out of St. Leo? And I did a little research and found out Fred Cambria, who pitched for the Pittsburgh Pirates. He's from
Pirates, yeah.
From Queens, yeah. Frank DePino, Brian Dayett, yourself, Jim Corsi, and there was a gentleman by the name of Frank Barrett who came out of St. Leo's College back in the 1930s. So that gives you an idea, folks, some major league talent coming out of St. Leo's down in Pasco County.
Yeah, and I got one for you that didn't play in the big leagues as a player, but he was the general manager, and that's J.P. Ricciardi, who's now with the Mets.
And he was from St. Leo's.
Yes, he was.
Outstanding. Yep. That's a good piece. I tell you, we're throwing the trivia back and forth, Bob, tonight. Right?
You got it. Yeah,
Bob Tewksbury with us, folks, tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, you played for the Yankees for 2 years. You played with guys like Willie Randolph, Mattingly, Hall of Famers, Winfield and Henderson, and you pitched with Ron Guidry.
Yes, I did. And, it was coming into New York, that rookie year was pretty remarkable. I had a really good spring training and made the team as the fifth starter. Actually took Phil Niekro's spot in the rotation and ended up, I actually got his number. I went from number 75 to number 35.
Not bad.
In spring training. We had Joe Niekro was on that team, Rick Rodin, Dennis Rasmussen, Gator, Palarulo, Mattingly, Randolph, Henderson, Winfield, Griffey Sr. So it was really a great team to play for. Lou was his
Lou
first
Pinella,
year managing.
Right.
But it wasn't easy. You know, I mean, as a young guy playing in New York, again, I said, you know, I came from a small town and went to Rutgers and went home. And then I get drafted and I make my way up to New York and now I'm in New York, which is, 100 times bigger than Rutgers. But I survived and, you know, I grew from it. It was a great opportunity. I was happy to be a Yankee and, forever a Yankee in some ways. So it was a great experience.
Gator's got a book coming out, too. I'm trying to get him on the show. It's called cleverly titled Gator, yeah, I don't know how he came up
magic.
With that. Yeah,
I don't know. You know,
but
a lot
we're going to be
time and energy.
Yeah. We're going to be talking about Bob's new book called 90% Mental, which he'll talk about his sports psychology with the Red Sox. But you went on to play with the Cubs, and you have more Hall of Famers in Sandberg and Dawson, as well as Greg Maddux. They had a pretty good team, and Gene Michael was your skipper over there.
He was. You know, Chicago wasn't a great time for me.
No.
I get traded for a fish. I was in the Steve Trout trade.
Yeah.
And I was hurt. I didn't pitch well. You know, people in the Wrigley bleachers said things about my mom that I never knew. I didn't know she wore army boots to fluff with my uncle.
Exactly.
You know, it was,
yeah.
But that was a tough time. But going to St. Louis was the best time, and that happened right after Chicago.
Yeah, you went 16-5 in 92, 2.16 ERA, and third in the Cy Young balloting.
Mm-hmm.
Not too bad.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, not too bad for a guy that was roaming around the minors, had two surgeries, and got demoted six times. So.
Yeah,
I'll take that. For
doing
sure.
Well, yeah. You had some shoulder and arm problems, and you became a control pitcher, and this is what kept you in the bigs.
Yeah, well, I always had decent control built, you know, but I threw 89, 90 miles an hour, and it was decent. And then after my shoulder surgery, my velocity went down to 86 ish, maybe one pitch at 87, but my control became pretty spectacular in the sense of, you know, not walking people. And I think you've done your research, obviously. You know, I had 233 innings in 1992 and only walked 20 people.
Right.
So,
right.
So it did get better and it got more refined, and it had to, or else I wouldn't have been in the big leagues, you know. Throwing 86, if you don't throw it to your spot, you're going to get killed.
Well, throwing 86 isn't too shabby. I can't throw it. I can't even drive 86, Bob, to give you an idea. So I'm hurting here. Talk about that stat, walking only 20 batters in 233 innings. What I found out about that, Bob, is it was the best ratio in the major leagues in over half a century.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty excited about that. And, you know, I think that people, you know of, and rightfully so, that strike out people and Cy Young Award winners. But I feel really I feel very lucky that all the work and the coaching that I had from a number of people that helped me to refine my mechanics allowed me to be able to be in the record books in a way under a category that not many people think about, but it's very important to success in baseball.
Now, we're speaking of Bob Tewksbury tonight. We're going to be talking about his new book in a little bit. I wanted to ask you, Bob, in 97, you developed I believe Rip Sewell came up with the name, the Ephus pitch, right?
The Ephus.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Talk
yeah,
about
actually,
that.
My son named it the two-finger dominator.
Yeah.
Because what the sign, you know, for a regular curveball was just two fingers down. But if it was two fingers and you wiggle them, that was the slow curveball. And my son was probably six or seven at the time, affectionately called it the Dominator because no one hit it. But yeah, I had some fun. I threw that. Probably the best example of that. I have a couple of stories actually. One was, we were playing the Cardinals, and I was with the Padres, actually. I threw it more with the Twins, but the one time I threw it with the Padres, Willie McGee was the hitter. I threw a first-pitch curveball for a strike that was 47 miles an hour.
Okay.
And I threw the next two pitches right down the middle at 86, and Willie McGee didn't swing. And the next day, he did not want to talk to me. He was so mad at me for... and I was like, Willie McGee is the nicest guy in the world. And he said, man, you're trying to embarrass me. And I said, Willie, I'm throwing 86 miles an hour. I'm trying to change speeds. And
yeah.
Willie said, well, after that first one, the next two looked like they were 100. So,
yeah.
and then I threw it to McGuire in Minnesota a couple of times, and he popped it up, and he ground it out, and I sent him over a note after the game that, you know, just said, hey, look, I wasn't trying to, you know, after Willie's comments, I wanted to make sure that I was cool with the hitters, and I sent him over a note and said, look, I wasn't trying to embarrass you. And he goes, man, I loved it. I'm a sucker for those. I would have swung at them all day long.
Yeah.
So that was a lot of fun. It, you know, to be able to have fun on the mound and you know, hitters aren't going to swing at a first pitch curveball that's 50 miles an hour. And they take it, and it's just the fans liked it. I liked it. It was a nice little niche I had.
There was a guy, Bob, that used to pitch for the New York Yankees by the name of Steve Hamilton back in the late 60s. And he threw what he called the folly floater. He'd stop in the middle of his windup and just throw the ball up in the air.
Float it in.
Right, and let it go. He threw one to a guy by the name of Tony Horton, who played for the Cleveland Indians one time. Tony popped it up, and what he did was he went back to the dugout, shaking his head, got to the on-deck circle, got down on his hands and knees, and crawled back into the Cleveland dugout.
Yeah,
that's one of my recollections of the EFIS or the folly floater. Yeah.
Yeah. See, mine was a real curveball. It had forward spin on it, and it was a true curveball. It just was really slow. I know Dave LaRoche threw the lob. He was my pitching coach. He pitched for the Yankees. His
right.
sons, obviously, they played pro ball, but he was my pitching coach in Columbus when I was there, and he threw the lob. And I think he just kind of did the same thing. He just kind of stopped in his motion and lobbed it up there. And, you know, hey, it's a game. They don't say play ball. You know, I mean, they don't say work ball. They say play ball. So
right. You
got to have fun.
Definitely. We're speaking of Bob Tewksbury tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Who was the greatest catcher or your favorite catcher to throw to?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I think that the first one that comes to mind is Terry Steinbach because,
right,
you know,
okay.
I was a veteran pitcher in Minnesota and he was a veteran player and, you know, we really shared a lot of stuff off the field with being away from young family and, you know, and just the life of a major leaguer as you get older and you're starting to transition out of the game. But, you know, Todd Pagnozzi, Pags was a gold glove winner in St. Louis and caught me for 4 years. And, you know, Pags is a really good catcher as well, gold glove winner, and as I said, and so, you know, but I always said, I used to tease the catchers. I used to say, you know, their backstops, you know, their job is to catch the ball, and if it goes to the backstop, to go back and pick it up.
Right.
I'm the one who makes they make suggestions, I make the choice, and,
okay.
That pissed a lot of catchers off, but essentially it was like,
yeah.
I got the ball. I'll tell you what I'm going to throw. You just catch it. So that's really how I felt about my job as a pitcher, was not relying on anyone else calling the game but me. And I think that's something that pitchers have fallen into a bad pattern starting in college with people calling pitchers for them along the way. They don't know how to pitch.
Like Casey Stengel said, Bob, without a catcher, you're going to have a lot of pass balls.
You know, Casey was, I think he's the one that named Gator's book, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, he might have come up with that idea. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I got to, if I ever do get him on the program, I'll find out and I'll shoot you a text as to how
well,
he came up
if you get him on
that.
The program, let me know what kind of stuff you're smoking or drinking, because that's going to be, you're talking about Casey, I'm talking about.
Oh, no, I'm talking about
Gator.
The Gator, yeah. No, Casey, I don't think he's doing interviews anymore.
About,
yeah.
I thought you were talking about bringing Casey back. I'm like, God, Bill, you got some power.
I'd love to get him on. Yeah, I'll tell you, I'd have to have a seance.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
We'd need a Ouija board here, Bob, or something to get him on. Yeah. Now, after you retired, Bob, you worked as a player consultant for the Red Sox, and you also did some broadcasting on NESN.
It was NESN, yes, NESN.
Yeah.
Yes, sorry, you broke it down. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. It was an opportunity to, that's when the pregame and postgame programming started in baseball, and I was part of that. I was in studio for the 2004 World Series, and that was remarkable, seeing the city of Boston celebrate the first world title in 86 years. And I really liked it. It was a tough choice because I was going back to graduate school at the same time and getting my master's in sports psychology and counseling at Boston University. And I had a choice to make because I really liked being on TV and talking about the game. It was kind of like I was pitching again, because you had to be prepared. You had to, you're on top of the bump. What are you going to do about it? And
right.
But in the end, I thought that, going into the mental skills coaching had a lot more longevity and security, and in some ways a lot more reward. So that's where I went.
I told Aruzioni that you were a BU guy. He told me no, so I'm going to have to text him and tell him that no.
You got to tell him.
Right. Uh-huh. You got your master's in psychology at BU. And,
that's right.
I'll make sure to set that record straight, too. Now,
yeah.
The book is called, folks, 90% Mental, An All-Star Player Turned Mental Skills Coach Reveals the Hidden Game of Baseball. Now, why did you decide to write this book, Bob?
Well, it's been a work in progress, actually, Bill, for a long time, because I thought that I had a unique combination of experience, both as a player and then as a mental skills coach, to share the inside part of the game. There are a lot of great practitioners and a lot of colleagues that are great mental skills coaches. And the one thing that separates me from them is that I played in the big leagues, and I think that there's some clout that comes with that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always help you. I think it helps you get in the door with players, especially those that might have a stigma with mental skills or something of the such. So I really wanted to just be able to reach out and talk about my story, and thankfully I had four great participants in the book that share their story and working with me on the mental skills aspect, and John Lester, Rich Hill, Andrew Miller, and Anthony Rizzo, all pretty prominent guys nowadays.
Sure.
And but this goes back to 2007-08, certainly up through 2013, when I was a member of the Red Sox when we won the World Championship. So, and I had a great co-writer in Scott Miller from the Bleacher Report. I had a great agent and Rob Kirkpatrick, who kind of found a vision and a theme of the message. And it's been really well received. And I think it's a baseball narrative. It's really not a how-to mental skills book. I talk about my career and honest dialogue of the challenges I faced and loss of confidence and why, and pitch by pitch sequences in the near perfect game I had against the Astros, my experience in being on the mound in the All-Star game and giving up six runs and two thirds of an inning and being pulled, to John Lester sharing his story about, our conversation in the dugout in Oakland at the midpoint of the 2013 season. So I think there's really a lot of good, unique insight into the mental game from various perspectives in this book, and I'm really excited about it.
And rightfully so. To me, Bob, there's certainly some great testimonials on the book jacket on the back, and to me, the one from Joe Torre is pretty prolific, because it says, Bob became an all-star not through physical gifts, but because he excelled on the mental side of a game that constantly challenges his players and their resilience. I thought that was a great quote from Joe Torre.
Joe Torre is a great man, and I talk about in the book an event that happened in Philadelphia where, a conversation I had with Joe really kind of changed my perspective on who I was as a pitcher. He's a great, great man. I'm thrilled to have won his first game as a Cardinal manager. I was the pitcher against the Phillies in Philadelphia. Yep. And, I still see him from time to time in his journey around the league and MLB. And he's truly, he's one of those guys that I don't think it's a coincidence the Yankees won the titles and had the success that they had because they had a great man leading the troops.
For sure. Now, people may be wondering, Bob, what exactly does a sports psychologist do? Do you take Dustin Pedroia and put a pendulum in front of his face and try to say, you'll get three hits tonight, you will get three hits?
No.
No, none of that. Okay.
No. I think, well, a couple of things that I respectfully will have to make a correction on. One is, and with respect to the people in the field that are sports psychologists, it's a common misconception of the people that do sports psychology or sports psychologists. I don't have a doctorate in sports psychology, so those that have a doctorate can be called sports psychologists. The name in baseball is more mental skills coaching.
But
a lot of people, that's a common thing. I just clarify that so the people listening, if they're sports psychologists, go, he's not a sports psychologist. What are you talking about?
The phones are ringing off the hook right now, Bob. Yeah, from irate listeners.
Yeah, and the second one, Bill, is that, I was with Pedroia with the Red Sox up until 2016, and then when the change came with Dombrowski replacing Ben Cherington, the Red Sox let me go. So last year I was with the Giants, and I'm with the Giants this year.
So that's why you're out in Arizona. Yeah, okay.
Exactly, yeah. And that's probably not updated in some of the literature that you've had. But Dustin Pedroia, talk about, I've been fortunate enough to be around some really great mentally tough players. With the Red Sox, Pedroia comes to mind, John Lester, and also, now with the Giants, Madison Bumgarner is a beast of his own. And it's really cool to not everyone, it's really cool to watch these guys play. Not everyone has that mindset. And I think that that's what I try to do is bridge the gap between the players that really, this is the missing link that they have to becoming that level player. Mm-hmm. So what do? I talk to players. I think this is where my playing background comes in. I know what it's like to, I've had two surgeries. I get traded. I get released. I get sent down seven times. I made an all-star team. I got knocked out in the first inning. There's nothing that these people, have gone through that I haven't in some way. I even batted, although not very well. I hit in the National League.
Sure.
Or I say I went to the plate in the National League. So what I do is, it's open to them. There's no mandatory meetings. There's no scheduled meetings. If a player has something that they would like to talk about, I'm available. And we sit down and we talk about what things that they might have going on and why. And then sometimes they're, one conversations, it could be about being away from the family and adjusting to life on the road and mom's home with two kids and how did you deal with that, to, a young pitcher that is, the game is speeding up on him because he's young and excited, and talking to him about how to slow the game down through breathing. And in the book I talked to John Lester about using imagery as a mental skill, that, to see himself succeeding, to put himself in the situation of the game prior to the game. And that's still an activity that he uses to this day. So it's kind of across the board. It's based on what the player wants and needs. And I try to fit those needs to help him play better.
Interesting. Definitely. Yeah. Now, you're with the Giants now. So what are you doing in spring training, Bob? Basically getting yourself acclimated to the Giants and the new team.
Yeah, exactly, Bill.
Okay.
Spring training is a time to for players to get to know me and me to get to know the players. It's also a time in which those players, mostly young guys, although not exception to the young guys, try to set in place a goal for the season with regard to things that they want to improve on. For example, you know, a hitter may say that he's wants to cut down on his strikeout rate, and because he gets anxious with two strikes, then we work on developing a two-strike approach that, you know, in collaboration with the hitting coach. And then you set some goals for that that you can measure over the course of the season. But it may also be a pitcher that was in big league camp for the first time that's trying to make an impression on Bruce Bochy and the team. And when he gets sent down, he doesn't understand why he gets sent down, because he pitched so well, but it's because there's no room. And so, you know, this is a time to form the relationships that hopefully during the course of the season the guys will reach out to you. And I travel, I see the team when they're on the road. I'm on all the road trips for two reasons. One is I didn't want to relocate to San Francisco, and I live in New Hampshire, and I can see the team when they come east. And two, I think players are very routine-based, and you've talked to hundreds of athletes in your career, and I think one thing that we all have in common is we like structure and a routine. And if the players know that I'm going to be on the road, then when I'm on the road, they know where to find me. And if with technology now, if I'm not with the team, we have multiple ways to stay in touch and reach out. So it works well for me, and it works well for the organization. And I'm really thrilled that, you know, I've got an opportunity here with the Giants. And, you know, we get a lot of ground to make up from last year, that's
yeah.
for sure.
Well, Bob, I tell you, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight. The book is called 90% Mental, An All-Star Player Turned Mental Skills Coach Reveals the Hidden Game of Baseball. It's available on Amazon, folks. Take a look at it. And thanks for taking the time out of your Sunday night to be with us, Bob.
Bill, thanks for making the time for me to come on. And love the show. I've listened back at some shows you had. It's wonderful. And thanks for having me. Take care.
No worries. All the best, Bob. Bob Tewksbury, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Mike Aruzioni and Bob Tewksbury, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you folks for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. We'll see you back on April 1st. No fooling. Until then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.